Graphic Audio. A movie in your ears. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands, narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Tim Carlin, Karen Carbone, Casey Jones, Sonny Lasky, Kate Torrey, James Konacek, and James Lewis. Deathlands number 44, Crucible of Time. Ryan Carter's head felt like someone had been using it to grind flour. He cautiously parted his lips and swallowed, tasting the bitterness of bile. It seemed as if a gang of muties had been using his mouth for an outhouse. He blinked open his good right eye, but the flash of dazzling light that drilled through the optic nerve into the forepart of his brain made him close it again immediately.
Fire blast.
He tried to gain a measure of control over mind and body. The Matran's jump from one gateway to another was never a pleasant experience, but some leaps were worse than others. He had only the briefest memory of starting the jump. All of them had sat down on the floor with its pattern of steel discs, matched by the ones in the ceiling. His back settled against the cold armaglass, with Christy Roth at his right and Dean, his son, on his left. Doc Tanner, Mildred Wyeth, J.B. Dix, and Jack Lauren had ranged themselves around the hexagonal chamber. The door had been slammed, triggering the mechanism that would whisk them from that location to someplace else in the blighted remnants of the United States, now known as Deathlands. They had no control over their destination. Ryan sat still, swallowing hard to avoid throwing up. He eased open his eye again, squinting to see how his companions had survived the jump. The first thing he noticed was the color of the armaglass walls of the chamber. They had been blue, now they were a deep maroon, like Vena's blood. As far as Ryan could tell, everyone else was still alive and breathing. Christy's head was on her shoulder, mouth open, her fiery scarlet hair coiled tight at her nape. Her long fingers were clenched tightly into the palms of her hands, and he could make out a worm of bright blood inching across the pale skin. Her emerald eyes were clamped shut, and a thread of saliva dangled from a corner of her lips.
Bad one.
Yeah, compadre, it was.
The voice that came from the far side of the Matran's unit was from J.B. Dix, the armorer, as he'd been known during the years when the two men had ridden together on the war wags of the legendary traitor. J.B. struggled to sit upright, feeling in one of the deep pockets of his coat for his spectacles. Pulling them out, he wiped the lenses on his sleeve and perched them back on his narrow nose, then picked his beloved fedora hat from his lap and jammed it on his head.
Yeah, bad one, bro.
Doc looks in a sorry way.
The kid doesn't look like he's ready for action either.
Not a kid, old man.
Lying on his right side, the kid's eyelids peeled back now, revealing the ruby eyes of the true albino. His skin, as white as new-fallen snow, was smudged with dirt across the high cheekbones. Jack Lauren, from West Lowellton in Louisiana, was still only 16 years of age, as skinny as a lath, with a wiry strength of a self-trained acrobat. His mane of white hair hung across his shoulders onto his leather and canvas camouflage jacket. Like the other companions, he carried a blaster at his hip, a satin-finished Colt Python with a long 6-inch barrel. But his favorite weapons were the half-dozen leaf-shaped throwing knives that he wore concealed about his person. Jack was able to take the eye out of the Jack of Diamonds at 20 paces. Or kill a man at three times that distance. As he flexed his arms and legs in preparation for sitting up, Ryan heard a stirring to his left. Peering over his shoulder, his eye met those of his son.
Damn it all to hell, Dad. That was a bad one. Worst jump I can ever remember.
Dean Cotter, at age 11, was a smaller mirror image of his father. He was the fruit of a brief liaison Ryan had had with Sharona Carson, wife of the Baron of Taos. Though Dean hadn't been long in Ryan's life, the one-eyed man loved him fiercely.
One of the worst, son. That's for bastard sure.
Christie stirred, then a full body spasm slammed through her. She lurched upright.
Gaia! Oh, that was
a bad one.
Yeah. Had a foul dream, if that's the right word for what dribbles through your skull during a jump.
Same here. I was strapped to a table of polished chrome, and men with white robes and masks were working on me with long tubes and needles, probing at my arteries, sucking my blood out into a whirling machine.
I was crawling through tunnels that were filling with warm mud.
Can't remember. Just know it was frightening. Old women in it, holding small knives, pecked like beasts of birds. Blood on the snow, like petals of roses.
Ryan reached out and took Christie's hand in his.
What was your dream, Christie?
I only recall bits, lover. I was held captive by a man who always stood in the shadows. The only way I could save myself was by completing a puzzle. Just one last piece was needed, but I couldn't find it. Didn't know what shape and size it was, so it was totally impossible, but I had to keep on searching. Nightmare Alley, lover. That's what it was. One of those black nightmares when you think you've actually lost your mind somewhere during the jump, like your brain's been swirled apart.
Mildred Wyeth had recovered consciousness while Christie was talking. She pressed her hands against her brown eyes to regain control.
Whew, I know what you mean. My dream was about traveling back in the days of Amtrak, when I was a little girl, before Skydark. I was wandering from platform to platform in a huge station trying to find the right train. Then, I was in a train car, but nobody knew where it was going. It was endless and pointless, like running, but never getting anywhere.
Mildred smiled at JB and patted him on the arm, using his help to stand, staggering a little. Ryan admired her toughness, knowing that he would almost certainly puke if he didn't stay sitting a while longer. But he already knew what a tough person Mildred was. Dr. Mildred Wyeth had been born way back in Lincoln, Nebraska, on December 17, 1964. Her father, a Baptist minister, had been burned alive less than a year after her birth by firebombing racists who hid their cowardice inside white hoods. 2 weeks after her 36th birthday, she had gone into the hospital for minor abdominal surgery that had gone badly wrong. Ironically, since cryonics was her medical specialty, she had been frozen to save her life. Very shortly after that, the world blew apart. But she slept dreamlessly on, her body monitored by a small, timeless nuke reactor, until she was finally discovered and awoken by Ryan and the others. Mildred shook her head to try to clear it. She pulled JB to his feet, adjusting her Czech ZKR 551, a six-shot target revolver, in its holster. Before being frozen, Mildred had been a silver medal winner in the free pistol shooting competition at the 1996 Olympics. She was the best shot with a handgun that Ryan Cotter had ever seen. Mildred massaged her forehead, then looked down at the motionless figure of Doc Tanner, who lay at her feet. He looked a lot worse for the wear and tear. The old man lay flat on his back, gnarled hands down at his sides. His grizzled hair was matted with sweat, and his breathing was harsh and irregular. Ryan crawled across the chamber and saw that Doc had been bleeding from both ears, as well as from the nose and mouth. His pale blue eyes were tight shut. It looked like he might have had some sort of convulsion, as his massive Lamar pistol had been jolted loose from the holster on his hip.
Doc? Doc!
There was no response. Mildred moved to join Ryan. She lifted an eyelid, peering down at Doc.
He seems to be in shock. Know how delicate the old bastard's mind is at the best of times? Well, this isn't the best of times, especially after what happened in Puerto Rico.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. A Whale with Two Kitties, or some such title. It is a far better rest I come from than was ever known. I'm quoting and misquoting, hither and thither, not to mention yon.
Sounds like he's in bad shape.
The old man opened his eyes and struggled to a sitting position, aided by Mildred. He wagged a forefinger at her.
Anoint thee, witch, thou rump-fed runyon. There's nothing wrong with my mind that a truly bad jump won't cure. I don't think that's quite what I meant to say. I mean that it was a poor jump, and it has sadly addled my pate for a few moments. Sadly addled. Badly, sadly addled.
Did you have any dreams while you were in the jump, Doc?
I think that I did.
There was a long pause. Jack got to his feet and leaned against the armaglass wall, his eyes closed, sucking in deep breaths. He ran his fingers through his long hair, bringing a semblance of order to it, then leaned down to help Dean to his feet.
Well?
Doc put his head on one side and peered up at Mildred, like an inquisitive buzzard.
Well, what, madam?
You said you had a dream during the jump, Doc. What was the dream about?
Ah, yes, indeed, the dream. By the three Kennedys, but it was passing strange. I was visiting an elderly aunt in Boston. It seems that I was betrothed to Emily, but not yet married. Aunt Alberta lived in a huge, rambling mansion on Beacon Hill, looking down toward the common. A somewhat gloomy building with stained glass at every door and window.
Is this going to take long, Doc? I have a life to get on with.
She had cats. Dozens of cats. Those very furry ones. Persians, I think they're called. They moved noiselessly through the corridors like a silent, great, gray wave rippling up and down the stairs. And their eyes were green-gold in hue. And they always seemed to be watching me, no matter where I went or what I did.
Maybe you could finish this story later, Doc, when we settle for the night. Sounds like it might go on for a while.
No, no, my dear Ryan. I'm nearly done.
Really?
Oh, indeed, yes. I found myself on the upper landing, which was where the maid's quarters had once been. It was thick with dust, and slates were gone from the roof, allowing a view of the leaden sky. Birds had nested up there, and the floor was covered in feathers and the brittle bones of dead pigeons. As I stood at the end wall, I turned and saw that my way back to the stairs was blocked by this silent army of cats, gazing at me with infinite menace.
Doc closed his eyes and sat quietly. After a few moments of stillness, Christy nudged him with the silver toe of her boot.
And? What happened then?
Why, I woke up, dear lady. That was what was so strange about the dream. It just stopped dead. Seeing as how I may never recover from Jamevu's damnable manipulations, I deem myself fortunate that I avoided the depths of an all-consuming nightmare.
That's it, Doc? It just stops? That's not much of a dream.
I can tell you it prickled the short hairs at the nape of my neck, dear boy.
Well, now that we've finished with Dream and Tell, I reckon we might do well to get going. See what sort of a redoubt we've ended up in.
Ryan crossed the chamber and stood by the door, and everyone got ready to move to condition red. Blasters were drawn and checked quickly, then cocked and held firm. Ryan put his left hand onto the cold metal of the handle of the armaglass door, looking around at his companions.
Here we go.
Do it, lover.
Got any kind of feeling?
Christy hesitated a moment, using her inherited mutie powers, trying to locate any imminent danger to them.
No. Nothing close by here.
Ryan scanned the faces of the others quickly, then opened the door of the Matran's chamber. The actual number of redoubts was still unknown. Some were scattered throughout the world, most in the old United States. There were a few redoubts that were on a modest scale concealed in isolated houses, but they were generally vast military complexes built during the intense Second Cold War that dominated life in the period immediately before the horrors of Skydark and the ensuing long winters. Many were hastily erected in wilderness areas, often using swaths of national parks. This caused great bitterness among conservationists, and bloody confrontations had erupted between the National Guard and outraged citizens. As Ryan stepped out of the gateway, he wondered what kind of place they'd find this time. The air seemed to have that familiar, stale, flat taste to it. The fact that everything was still functioning meant that the master reactor control was still working, checking the lights and air quality, maintaining a tight and sometimes lethal security system, operating as it had been designed to do approximately 100 years earlier. But some of the redoubts had been infiltrated, and moving into a strange complex was always fraught with danger. The companions usually remained on condition red for much of the time. Ryan found himself in a small square room, about a dozen feet across. Most of the redoubts that he'd visited had been abandoned and stripped bare, some obviously deserted in the pre-nuke panic those last few hours before the missiles darkened the skies and the United States became Deathlands. In the past, they found arms, food, and even beds. Sometimes people, sometimes muties. This room was painted in a light cream color with a matte finish. It was totally empty, except for a small rectangular plastic-topped table against the sidewall, with four tubular steel legs. There was a single narrow shelf on the opposite flank, but that too was empty. Occasionally, they had come across pre-nuke graffiti, but these walls were flawless and clean. There was another vanadium steel sec door on the opposite side of the room. The others entered the room, Christy close on Ryan's heels.
Seems safe, lover.
Not too bad. I've smelled a lot worse.
Ryan moved to the opposite door, his finger tight on the trigger of his 9mm 6-hour P226 pistol.
Ready?
He reached out with his left hand, depressed the cold metal handle, and inched the door open. Ryan hesitated, taking in a deep breath, as did everyone else.
Yeah, it's better here than in chamber. Fresher.
Kind of a pine scent.
Yeah. Must mean we're close to a forest of some kind.
Let's go look. Forest means there's game.
Ryan swung the heavy door slowly open, revealing what they'd all expected to see, a large room containing the main control section of the Matrans unit. Digital displays on more than 40 screens were in constant flux, altering every nanosecond, endlessly changing numbers, codes, and formulas. They monitored every aspect of what had once been called Project Cerberus, a tiny cog in the infinitely complex system known to a selected few as the totality concept. On the far side, past the rows of control consoles, the wall was dominated by a huge sextile door. It was in the closed position, sealing off that section of the redoubt against anything short of a full nuke missile attack. Ryan holstered his pistol.
If by any chance the sec door starts to open, it'll give us a good half-minute warning. Down to condition orange.
The rest of the group of friends put away their blasters and wandered around the rows of desks, seeing if anything had been left behind that might give them a clue as to where they were and what had happened.
The waste bins are devoid of any contents.
No notes or anything like that.
Mildred perched herself comfortably in a dark gray orthopedic swivel chair and revolved slowly with her head back, looking up at the rounded ceiling.
Sec cameras are still functioning. Wonder if anyone's watching us. Probably not, I guess.
She lifted her hand and gave a casual wave to the nearest of the security devices that had a tiny ruby light glowing at its top. Standing near her, JB took off his glasses and wiped them carefully on his sleeve.
Nothing. Place swept as clean as this likely means no food or weapons in the rest of the redoubt. Might as well move on, Ryan.
Right. Back onto red, people.
As was usual, Dean hurried forward to operate the mechanism that opened and closed the sec doors. Sticking his blaster in his belt, he moved to the side of the entrance and lay both hands on the green steel lever. He was ready at his father's word to move it to the upward position that would start the ponderous door moving slowly, opening the way to the rest of the complex. It was a moment of considerable danger. Ryan moved to the opposite side of the door from Dean, crouching as close to the concrete floor as he could, his blaster drawn again, ready to squint through the narrow gap that would appear beneath the sec door.
Everyone else take cover behind the control consoles. Go, Dean. I'll be ready to stop instantly, on my word.
The boy threw his weight against the green lever, heaving it upwards. There was the familiar faint rumbling sound of buried gears engaging deep within the walls. Ryan felt the trembling of movement through his knees, seeing the almost imperceptible beginning of action. Somewhere, on the far side of the vast door, he could just catch the faint sound of a warning siren. If there was anyone living in the redoubt, it would give them ample warning of the arrival of intruders. A narrow gap appeared between the bottom of the door and the floor, and Ryan flattened himself to peer beneath it. He saw the corridor outside, brightly lit, and the wall. There was no sign of any kind of life. The gap was now about 7 inches high.
Hold it, Dean.
Christy, you feel anything?
There was a pause while Christy closed her eyes and pushed her mind to go questing into the redoubt.
No, Lover, I can't feel anything.
All the way, Dad?
Sure.
The lever moved from the horizontal, and the great weight of sex steel began to slide slowly upward again. Ryan crouched on hands and knees, watching as more of the passage outside was revealed. He saw concrete sloping to an arched roof that was illuminated by strip lighting. He could also see the first of an expected number of set cameras fixed high up where the roof and walls ran into one another. The door was now almost completely open, leaving a gap of better than 6 feet.
Stop it right there, Dean. I'll take a look outside in the corridor.
The barrel of Ryan's powerful blaster probed the air in front of him as he glanced around the corner of the opening, checking both ways. Both were empty. The scent of pines was noticeably stronger out in the passage, and he could feel a light draft coming from the right. Ryan eased down the hammer on the 6-hour.
It's clear. Everyone ready?
Most of the redoubts that they'd visited had the same sort of layout. The gateway chamber and control room were almost always in the deepest part, often far below ground level. Ryan turned to the left, walking only a few paces along the curving passage, before coming up against a wall of raw, impenetrable rock, dark granite streaked with bands of silvery quartz. Again, this feature was common to most redoubts.
Back the other way.
Ryan walked past the rest of them, taking the lead. Christy fell in behind him, followed by Jack, Dean, and Doc. Mildred came sixth, with JB bringing up the rear. Now the wide sweep of the passage opened up before him, with set cameras dotted in the angle between wall and ceiling about every 30 paces. The tiny ruby lights flickered on and off, under the random control of Comp Central.